180 of the Water's Wavelength podcast. I'm your host, Weishan, and I have Tony with me here. AT, it's our 280th episode. Can you believe that?
I mean, I'm amazed that we got past two, actually. You know, this thing is so terrible. But, you know, we have good guests. And fortunately, we have a guest today. But before we get to the guest, let me just say, for those in New York that are, you know, we're in the New York area, it's getting about that time. I don't know. We're in March now, so might as well start plugging this, even though I'm not a big fan of plugging things, but here we go. We have the North American Financial Information Summit, otherwise known as NAFIS. It's going to be May 16th. It's going to be at 360 Madison, which is a building in Midtown. It's going to have two tracks. NAFIS has always been a data conference, but we're actually trying to make it a little bit bigger, trying to get toward the expo area, you know, trying to be the cool kids, you know. So we're going to do a bit of an expo. It's going to have one track data, one track technology. And I know what you're all saying. How do you differentiate between data and technology? Well, you know, you just show up on May 16th at 360 Madison Avenue and watch my brilliant hosting skills and interviewing skills on display. So that's what you need to know right now. Who's our interview guest today?
Well, he would definitely fit into the tech track, I guess. Our guest this week is Daniel Liebau. He's the founding chairman of Lightbulb Capital. I bring him on to talk about DeFi and some of the stuff that he's working on. He's got a lot on his plate, but yeah, and we talk about the intersection of like DeFi and TradFi. Yeah, there we go.
Can't wait.
Let's get to it. Okay, and now I'm joined by Daniel Liebau. He's the founding chairman of Lightbulb Capital. Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. But before we get into our topic for today, or for this week, rather, for the benefit of our listeners here, could you give us an overview of Lightbulb Capital and a little bit about your background, please?
Sure. So yeah, my name is Daniel Liebau. I'm half German, half Argentinian. I grew up in Germany with an Argentinian dad and a German mom. But I've lived in Asia since 2009. Mm-hmm. And yeah, most of my time spent in Asia is in Singapore and also in Hong Kong. The company Lightbulb Capital is really a research and an advisory firm, also has some training business related, always related to blockchain, because that's all we focus on. And aside from that, I also have another hat, which is I'm an affiliate faculty member at Singapore Management University, where I also have a few classes that also focus on digital assets and blockchain and decentralized finance as well. And lastly, because I like to overload myself, my PhD is about how blockchain technology basically impacts financial markets. And one of the examples of something that's already out there is a paper on security tokens, which is now aging quite nicely and racking up citations. So I'm very happy with that.
Oh, great. You send me the link, I will include it. And sure. Yeah, so that our listeners can also have a look at that. So our topic for today, I would really love to talk about DeFi and the impact that we're seeing, in the traditional finance world. Because I think, I guess, in the past couple of years, it has really picked up, in terms of mentions.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's still a lot of concern, and also, I think some market participants are just kind of like waiting with bated breath, you know, like, oh, yeah, Let's just take a wait and see approach, what will happen, you know. Or there's the other extreme where they're like, nah, we're not gonna get to a decentralized state. You know, so maybe we could start with the definition of decentralized finance or DeFi, because in my past few years covering this the space of technology in the capital markets, I've heard it described to me in various ways. So okay. What is your definition? What is the best definition that you've come across for DeFi?
I mean, I think there are a number of different definitions. That is probably true. I just think of DeFi as basically financial services that are provided without intermediary and on top of a public blockchain. But, you know, some people argue that it's probably a lot more. It's also a movement, right? Because where a lot of the friction, I believe, from traditional finance and decentralized finance comes from is that there's competition, right? The idea behind DeFi is we should not be very reliant on intermediaries, and all of traditional finance is basically run by intermediaries. So I can understand how maybe it's been around for a while, but then it's not been adopted so much just yet, because it's a new concept and it's also something that is a little bit rebellious if you think about it.
Okay, so I understand that you're also working on a paper for your PhD, right? And it's a DeFi 2034 paper. I guess maybe without giving too much away, because it's not published yet, but you know, what are some of the highlights from that paper? And I guess what is some of the motivation, from you that, you know, got you interested in that space to begin with?
Yeah, so it's not part of my PhD, but it's a separate research paper that I'll present at some academic conference later in the year. So indeed, it's the first time I actually get to talk about it in public, so quite exciting. Well, the idea really came from another researcher's work that is investigating the effects or possible effects in about a decade's time of AI in financial services. So I thought, I read that exercise and I thought, okay, that's interesting. Why don't we just amend a little bit and then also do a similar exercise for decentralized finance? Because as I was seeing regulators getting interested in DeFi, and you know, MAS is obviously in Singapore leading the charge here, I think, you can actually tell that there's something more than just this a little rebellious crew of people who want to offer something on the blockchain, right? So since I had looked a lot into kind of the renegade DeFi, I thought, yeah, that would be an interesting question to ask. You know, what's the effect of this DeFi phenomenon on traditional financial services 10 years from now? Because 10 years from now is not, you know, too far away, but it still gives a little bit of time for things to develop. So the idea behind the paper is really to add some value to financial services practitioners, also the regulators and the policymakers, so not only the people who work in the industry, to allow them to explore a little bit what the possible outcomes can be, right? Of course, I don't have a crystal ball, and nobody that we've asked in the survey also has one. But if you can kind of combine the insights from several experts, then perhaps we can start to form different views about different outcomes with regards to DeFi and finance.
So I'm curious, In speaking to all these experts, right, and particularly in traditional financial services, where would you say is the where has there been the most like misunderstanding around how DeFi is, you know, going to play a part in traditional finance, either to shake it up completely or to to what extent is it going to be a big?
So one thing that is actually quite without bragging too much, but one thing is quite cool about the paper is that we ask three different groups to comment on all of these survey questions that we sent out. So the first group were basically people that attended my DeFi class. So this DeFi class is an executive education class. So you have people with experience in the classroom, mostly from you know, banks and funds and so on. But also a fair amount of regulators, actually. So if you think about, you know, how to characterize this group, they're probably quite conservative compared to some other people that we've asked.
Right.
We then also asked people who work in the DeFi industry. And of course, you'd expect them to be a little bit more positive, right? Because they work every day in and out to kind of push the DeFi agenda. And then the third group were basically scholars, right? People who come from academia and investigate this DeFi phenomenon. And you hope that they are a little bit more neutral and quite objective. So if you take the three groups together, you can do interesting things. You can, of course, look at the overall results, but then you can also slice and dice by group and see how these groups kind of differ in opinion, right? So we got a total of, I think, 109 people. That's quite a lot, actually, for this type of research that we did here, which we call an expert elicitation. So it's not a regular survey where you just, you know, go out to consumers or anything like that. And we got a fairly good mix of people who are, I mean, they're all experienced, but across the sort of spectrum of years of experience, you have people with over 20 years, but then you also have some that are between 1 and 5. But each of them have their individual angle. So I think that's important to have this mix so that we can also avoid some of the typical biases.
Okay, so I'm just interested in the process that it took for you to, I guess, comb through the survey results.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of what we write about and talk about on this podcast has to do with data.
Sure.
Just from that kind of perspective, can you walk me through how you collected the data,
sure.
How you processed it, cleaned it, normalized it,
yeah.
to make sure that you could actually make sense of it?
Yeah, totally. So we collected with a Google Forms, very simple. Google Forms is, I think, it's quite good. We had, of course, a little bit of a disclaimer, How would I call this? It's a bit of text that says, that assures the participants that we're not gonna reveal the identity and so on. So I think that's kind of good practice. Mm-hmm. Once we collected everything, we indeed had to make it all machine readable, as it were. So there's a little bit of data massaging and transferring actual answers to kind of ones and zeros and other numbers. But actually, all the analysis and also the creation of all the charts that will go into the paper, I've done with Python. Within Python, there are great modules like Matplotlib and Seaborn that can do great charts. Of course, there are also basic things for calculations like pandas and NumPy. I do use this tool that a friend of mine, Carol, has recommended to me. It's called DataSpell. It's a front end to write Python codes, and it's very, very user friendly. So if you or your audience want to check it out, I think it's quite a good tool. I have no affiliation to them, but I'm a fan of the product. And of course, my Python skills are also limited. So whenever I get stuck, I ask ChatGPT to help me out with
nice.
the exact coding, and I don't feel bad about it because, you know, I just stand where I stand. You got to make use of the technology that's available, I think.
Interesting. Okay, so I mean, just coming back to the impact that DeFi will have on the financial, on traditional finance.
Yeah.
You know, what are some, I guess, possible future scenarios in looking at that?
So in line with that other research that is trying to look a little bit more at the sort of AI side of things, we come up with 5 different scenarios that are possible scenarios. And, you know, some of them are arguably a little bit more likely than others, but I'll just call them out. So the first scenario is nothing happens. You know, DeFi disappears. Finance as usual, we call it. Intermediaries keep their roles as today. The second one is what we call highly regulated DeFi, which is basically a scenario where all of these DeFi players emerge and just have to make sure that they comply with all of the existing and also potentially new regulation for financial services across all the different activities, right? It can be borrowing and lending and exchanging and tokenization, all these other things. The third one is also interesting. It's we call it DeFi platform revolution. It's basically TradFi really struggles and everything looks a little bit more like DeFi in the future. You know? The fourth one is about collaboration between traditional finance and decentralized finance. And that's a particularly interesting one, also because of what we discussed earlier around the frictions. So this is a scenario that assumes that both sides realize that they actually are better off if they collaborate and perhaps take best of both worlds and then combine. And the last one is a little bit ambitious, I suppose, but is one where basically finance is turned into this public good and everyone is sustainably trying to provide financial services for, you know, the man on the street and also other organizations, whether they are DAOs or large companies.
Last scenario sounds nice. It sounds pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
Due to capitalism, I don't know how that will happen.
Exactly. But you know, when you do this kind of survey research, you gotta show different options also to elicit a little bit the creativity and get people to think about these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the last option there is actually the hope, right? And we all want to do. You want to have something for good, for the good of people, right? For the good of the market. When I say people, it just means financial institutions as well. But you know, maybe that's a conversation for another day. Tell me a little bit more about this best of both worlds scenario, where there is a collaboration with DeFi and TradeFi, kind of like, I guess, an intersection, if I can use the word, I guess, a perfect intersection of both worlds, possible or not, I don't know. But what would that look like? So considering the current intermediaries that we have, so let's take, for example, the custodians that we have, or maybe even looking at an exchange, you know, so if they were to collaborate with a DeFi player or platform, how would that look like?
Yeah. I mean, again, no crystal ball, but I think there are probably two or three things that I can say with reasonable confidence. So if this scenario was to plan out, then there's a base assumption. And that base assumption is that you have at least some sort of digital representation of financial markets products on top of blockchains, right? Because otherwise the whole concept doesn't work. So that means that tokenization is indeed, I mean, it's a little bit overused by now, this word, but indeed is a very important part, because you can't really have anything DeFi looking without having tokens on top of a blockchain, right? Because that's how DeFi operates. So that's the base layer. That means that traditional financial institutions will have to have custodial technology that supports this sort of thing, right? And I think there are already a number of vendors, again, not affiliated to any of them, but you look at companies like Fireblocks or Metaco or something like that, that are basically technology vendors that are selling this type of technology into large financial institutions. So that's the base layer. The second layer that gets a little bit more interesting is when we take some of these, what we can perhaps call DeFi primitives or mechanisms that exist in DeFi, and apply them to more traditional financial services. So one of the mechanisms, perhaps as example, is that of an AMM, an automated market maker. It's something like an exchange on top of a blockchain that functions without an entity that runs an exchange. So people can exchange tokens peer-to-peer through that technology. And that is something that is what we call crypto native. You know, it came out of the cryptocurrency markets. But there are now researchers that are already investigating well, hang on a minute, can we use this in other contexts, right? So for example, MAS is pushing the boundaries and trying to explore whether this technology can be used for emerging FX markets. There's another
paper. Is that covered under Project Guardian?
I'm not very sure because they have a few different initiatives. A good reference, by the way, and this is the one shout out that I will make, is that my friend Kenneth Bock has recently published a new book on decentralized finance, and he talks a lot about how, you know, how eventually DeFi also has to get regulated. So I think it's a good reference for people who want to follow up and spend a little bit more time on this topic. But back to this AMM mechanism, right? So there's also research by a professor in Toronto who effectively explores whether this AMM technology can be used in equity markets, you know? And the findings are surprising. He says, yeah, it's actually quite a good mechanism, if I remember correctly. I will have him as a guest on my podcast later. So for anyone who's interested, can also tune into that. But you can already tell that there is exploratory type of work going on that aims to look at some of these DeFi concepts and how to kind of make them workable in the world of traditional finance.
I'm just interested. So like in that research paper by that professor in Toronto that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and applying that automated market maker in the equities market, does that mean then that the current market maker kind of role within traditional finance goes away, or would there be a role for them to still play a part in that space?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and I think one of the things that is extremely important when we talk about these collaborations, or you know, what can traditional finance do to be part of this new financial ecosystem? I think the most important thing here is to realize that you cannot eventually replicate 100% what you're doing now, right? And because in my mind, and I quote a friend of mine, he always says, if you try to do that, you're sending an analog signal into a digital world. And I kind of agree, right? So if you say, well, I'm an intermediary and I don't care whether it's now a decentralized world, I'm just an intermediary, I want to keep doing what I'm doing, then probably you're going to fail. But what we can realize is that banks and other financial intermediaries actually also can reinvent themselves, and they can take different roles, and they can look at new ecosystems and technologies and say, okay, traditionally I've been doing, I don't know, borrowing and lending activity, but now I see some phenomenon in the world of crypto and decentralized finance, and perhaps it has to do with, and I'm pulling this out of my head right now, but there's some service around staking, for example, and then maybe I explore that, right? And then I become a premier, fully regulated, very solid provider in this new staking service, for example. So I think people from traditional finance probably best off if they allow for a little bit of creativity to reinvent themselves, and then their roles can remain super relevant. Yeah? I think in this case of the AMMs specifically, there are some similar looking roles. So there are people who are what we call a liquidity provider. That can be quite a passive role compared to what we think of when we think of as a market maker in equities, for example. But as these AMMs evolve, there is also more and more opportunity to be a rather active trader as a liquidity provider. And I think that is a interesting opportunity for traditional finance to use, because that's, you know, there's a whole range of companies like the flow traders and the IMCs and so on of the world that are in this business of market making anyway, why wouldn't they also be able to engage with this new AMM technology? They probably already trialing and testing in the crypto markets for what's there to come in the future.
Right. I like that point that you mentioned that, you know, sending an analog signal into the digital world just wouldn't work because, well, they're two different worlds. So like you can't just replicate 100% of what is in the traditional finance world into the, I guess, the decentralized finance world.
It's a great it's a great statement. Yeah. I wish it was mine, but it was from my friend and colleague.
It's funny because I and you know we speak to a lot of technologists, a lot of people in data, and obviously, for banks, asset managers, these so-called traditional finance companies or service providers, you know, it's their foray or their use of technologies to make their current business, their existing business, better, more efficient, as well as looking into other new businesses, has been maybe a little bit of that. So, okay, sorry, if I can take an example of, let's say, the use of the cloud. And I think when in the past couple of years, the use of cloud has skyrocketed, particularly, you know, in banks, gone are the days where they are like, public cloud, no, can't do anything on public cloud, or it has to be private because, you know, we need the security and all that. And to some extent, that still exists. But at the same time, we see all these, you know, new partnerships with Google, with AWS, and so on and so forth. But from speaking to some people and in context and sources, you know, there's still a common mistake where, you know, they would lift and shift what was a legacy application or a legacy system, for example, and or a workflow, and just put it on the cloud. Yeah. And perhaps there are some areas where that is totally fine. I mean, I don't work in a bank myself, so I don't know, right? But then, when do you come to a point where you have to like re-engineer a solution or a workflow to, you know, use the entire benefits of the cloud?
Yeah. So I think I know where you're going with this. So my short answer to that is that these sort of things depend on where on the technology stack you are working on, right? So the lower you are, the easier it is to make the mistake to not use new technology native type of approaches, right? So you look at cloud technology as something is, I mean, it's effectively data center outsourcing plus plus, right? That's how many traditional technologists in banks will look at it and will say, okay, we used to have our own data center, now this other company runs it for us. But then you and I know that, you know, cloud technology obviously has lots more to offer than that. And then you miss out. Now, there's a very nice paper on the technology stack of decentralized finance. And what this paper, I can send you the link later on as well. What this paper nicely describes actually is how, you know, different layers sit on top of each other in DeFi. And then you fairly quickly get to an application layer, right, where there's business logic. So when you have to interact with an AMM, just to stick with that example, it's not so easy to say, well, I'll just port my own kind of methods over, because the rules of the game, as it were, just completely change, right? You have different actors, you have different kind of mechanisms that are at play. You have different sources of revenue as well. So I think that requires you to engage a little bit more than just to use some sort of subset of what a technology has to offer in the cloud case, for example. Yeah, okay. it's also, I guess anything on blockchain is, it has a different objective than technology had traditionally in finance, right? So traditionally, I mean, I've been in banking technology for so long before I started all this crazy ride. And then, you know, effectively it's all about cost income ratio. Like, can you lower the cost income ratio? And that's how you get promoted. Make things more faster, cheaper, better, right? But then blockchain is not really about that. It's about being able to verify, getting rid of the intermediaries and so on. So there's a different value proposition. So I think one of the key messages perhaps is also, if you try to engage with DeFi, keep that in mind and don't think about it, oh we got to do this because then everything's cheaper. You know, that's kind of a side effect of it, but it's maybe not the main reason why this even exists.
I think because like now we're in 2024, right? The days of that blockchain hype has dwindled a little bit. I think back in 2016, 2018, you know, people, when I say people, I mean companies were still, you know, left and right having POCs about using blockchains for whatever. And yeah. it seemed like that was more I guess an exercise of you know, a hammer looking for a nail type of situation, right? Yeah. And maybe now it has graduated to a point where, okay, it's not useful for everything.
Yeah.
But perhaps there are use cases where, you know, it could come, blockchain or DLT, if I can use it interchangeably,
yeah,
would be useful. So, I mean, I guess some practical examples today would be, let's say, the private equity blockchain that I think Northern Trust actually had, which now is run by Broadridge, for example. Mm-hmm. So do you think, I mean, and I guess in talking to other firms out there, other people, you know, for your paper and things like that, do you also see the same kind of mindset around blockchain now? Are they like, okay, is this a particular use case that could actually, or it could benefit from the use of blockchain, rather than, okay, there's blockchain, there's AI, yeah, there's cloud, we can apply it to everything.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that hammer and nail issue is certainly, you know, is an important thing to think about, because otherwise what you end up doing is like lipstick on the pick kind of exercise, right? Oh yeah, I also got some blockchain project. It's useless. You just spend money for nothing. I mean, the most interesting recent trend that I see within perhaps more established financial services companies is that they warm up to this idea of public blockchains. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, there were many kind of exercises to say, yeah, we should do something on blockchain, but, you know, it better be my blockchain, and that's why it's private, and I decide who joins in, and it kind of destroys the whole idea of you know, this whole thing about openness and anyone can join and so on that public blockchains actually come with. So I think that is quite exciting to me. You look at, for example, lots of the tokenization activity in North America. For some reason, Avalanche seems to be the public blockchain that people like to use. Maybe it's because they have this concept of subnets that can be controlled separately, right? But in the end of the day, still using a public layer one ecosystem. And I've had the chance to speak to some kind of C-level people in traditional finance in large firms, and they also say, yeah, we are exploring that now, right? And that to me it's probably the biggest shift, because it's very similar to saying, okay, I can finally move my IT system into AWS, you know, because then you kind of accept that you also create a little bit of a dependency to these layer one platforms. And that is kind of not part of this paper, but of another one that I'm working on. It's like the characteristics, the characteristics of these platforms are important to understand, right? Because they're not all the same. And financial services companies have lots of regulatory obligations when it comes to stability or fairness or, you know, predictable pricing and so on, that I think will be crucial in the future.
Okay. I guess it's just as a last question here. What are some good examples of some capital markets firms that are already experimenting in the DeFi space that you think should be highlighted more?
I mean, I guess the innovation in the trading space really comes from people that sit across traditional finance and the crypto markets. So if you think about companies like, perhaps flow traders or jump trading or these kind of guys, you know, they're really very knee deep into both markets. And that's more than experimentation, as it were, because they have a P&L, right? And then that it becomes quite serious. So I think that's interesting. Firms who have proprietary capital obviously have a little bit more flexibility around what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Remember how in DeFi, one of the key things, aside from the openness, is also that you don't really know who you're dealing with, right? So there's a whole bunch of regulation around having to know who you deal with in TradFi, right? Because you want to make sure that you don't engage or support, even if unknowingly, any sort of rogue activity. So I think these things are a little bit on the edge, but that's where also regulators that set up their sandboxes and try technologies out, for example, FCA in the UK and also, of course, MAS in Singapore are making good progress. And what all of this highlights is that probably, and it's also something actually that comes out in the survey, what will be more and more important is this understanding of data management, privacy, and security. Yeah. And that is often something that is a little bit left behind. Like everyone gets excited about cryptocurrency, but then the crypto bit is kind of, you ask people about the details of what's possible and what's not possible is not so well known. So I think I would also encourage people to try and learn more about cryptography. Cryptocurrencies have been around for over 10 years now, but cryptography, I think, is still quite a foreign concept for most people. So it's worth learning. Not that I'm an expert, I also learn every day, but I think it's worth learning more than we know on average.
Great. Well, I think it's a good wrap up there to what we discussed. It'll be interesting to get you on at a later stage, you know, talking about the actual results of your paper.
Sure.
Or maybe the other one that you're working on as well. How many are you working on?
It's too many, I guess. That's why I'm too slow. But I guess one thing that maybe two things that I also wanted to highlight just before we wrap up. So one is that pretty much all departments, at least this is what we learned from the survey, right? Pretty much all departments in financial services firms will be affected. Yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's the management themselves or risk or operations or marketing or finance, that there's an impact across the board. So I think that should probably lead us to try and learn more about it, yeah, so that we're prepared. And I think the other thing I wanted to briefly mention is there's a whole cross-section of issues that are that come to the face of the earth on the back of this DeFi phenomenon. And they can be ethical issues, they can be issues around data as well, they can be issues around privacy. Again, lack of expertise inside of this DeFi space, of course also regulatory matters, and eventually also budgeting and funding. So it's really quite a broad section of issues that have to be overcome. But then there are also opportunities on the back of it that we may not have included in our projections if we just think in the kind of traditional finance mindset.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, there's definitely still a lot to explore there. Yeah, as I mentioned, maybe we'll get you on again to talk about some of the, I guess, limitations or the considerations, particularly looking at the regulatory front, because as we all know, banks, asset managers, highly regulated space.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's never going away. If anything, maybe it'll be increasing.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to look at how they would, you know, have to deal with this on top of all the other regulatory obligations that they already have.
Yeah.
All fun.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast, Dan. It's great to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. It was great fun.